once you practice empathy, it's not about trying to please everyone. It's about being fully informed. So you're not surprised at how different people might react to your decision or the impact your decision might have on them, because you've actually spent time listening and feeling and engaging.
Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard.
And I'm Kalita Stafford. Hello, and welcome everyone to the latest episode of the IDOU Creative Confidence Series. Today, we are joined by Jim Keane of Steelcase, President and CEO. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
So today, Jim will be hearing about his perspective on leadership and the role of empathy and distributed decision-making in leadership. So I see that you are actually broadcasting from Steelcase headquarters in Michigan, but I'd love to actually hear about your home office situation. Can you share a little bit about what's your home office?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in my home office, just like everyone else, over the last few months. And the first thing, I guess, is that it's got a door. I mean, that is the first thing, the most important thing about a home office, so you can have privacy, acoustic privacy, and freedom from interruption. And so that's awesome. And it's also filled with Steelcase furniture, of course. One thing I didn't expect was I've been doing a lot of town hall meetings, virtual town hall meetings from my home office. And I didn't really pay much attention to what was in the background, but people kept sending me texts asking me about the guitar. I have a Fender Stratocaster guitar in the background. So suddenly this thing that I thought was just something I do at home became a topic of conversation at work. So I think we're all learning that, you know, as we look into the backgrounds of people's offices, we learn things about each other that maybe we didn't know before. So a little surprise there.
That is, and so you actually play it.
I actually play it, yeah. Like, that's a great way to take a break.
What's your go-to song?
These days, I'm trying to learn Clapton, so as many Eric Clapton songs as I can learn, and I start with the easiest ones possible, because the guy is unbelievable, so I have very humble skills.
Very nice. Thank you, Jim. So Jim is broadcasting out of Michigan. I am broadcasting out of California. And yes, the home office, very important. I have two kids, and we have four video conference calls going on right now as we all work and attend school. So this is a situation a lot of us are in. So today, let's talk about leadership, and we have to acknowledge the context we're in. The circumstances of late, between a global pandemic, economic crisis, systemic racism, all of these are challenging what it means to be a leader. And it's raising the question of, what does it mean to be a good leader? How are the skills and mindsets of leaders shifting? And what is being called for of leadership skills in the future? And so I'm so thrilled to have you here today, Jim, because so much of shifting as leadership is approaches that you have been embracing as part of your principles as a leader at Steelcase for many years. And so today we're going to talk about that. And our hope is a lot of us will leave today with some tangible tips and advice for how we might keep evolving our leadership skills in the face of rapid change, ambiguity. Jim, is there a piece of leadership wisdom that guides you right now?
So I think this is a time when it's hard to put yourself in a place where you actually have a chance to listen, but I think listening and understanding what people are feeling is super important. And I think that's always been the thing that fuels leadership most effectively.
So Jim Keane is president and CEO of Steelcase. Steelcase is the largest global leading office furniture manufacturer in the world, locations all over the globe, and it's over 108 years old. Jim has been with Steelcase for over 20 years, working in various roles, including COO and CFO. You currently serve on a variety of boards, including IDEOs, as well as the Business Roundtable. And throughout your career, Jim, you have been passionate about listening to and interacting with both your customers and employees, so you might build a more inclusive workplace. And we're going to talk about all that today. It's worth noting as well, IDEO and Steelcase has a long business relationship history of over 30 years. And 20 of those, Jim, you have been involved, including, as I said, serving on IDEO's board. We are so thankful to have you here today to get your perspectives.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be part of this.
Yeah. So we are going to talk about leadership, but I know this question will come up, so I do want to at least ask it. Steelcase, as a leading industry in office furniture, in the work environment, how has Steelcase been affected, and what do you see on the horizon for your industry?
Yeah, so I think the big question everyone's asking is what happens when people come back to the office, and that's a big question for us, of course, and we're talking about that with all of our clients, doing a lot of research on that topic. So I'll just give you a few sneak peeks into what we're thinking. So first of all, the office has to be able to support privacy more effectively than it did before. I think people have seen the power of privacy when they're working from home and depending on your home situation. So you shouldn't have to work at home to get privacy to be able to concentrate in an uninterrupted way. And so we think offices will be more focused on privacy. But offices also have to get collaboration right, knowing that in the future there will be people who will continue to work from home and work remotely. We are not going to be content anymore to just have that remote person be a voice on a speakerphone in the middle of the table. We're used to being able to see each other and hear each other and have kind of a democracy of participation in meetings. Most meeting rooms aren't designed for that. And so there's going to be a need for people to rethink that. Mm-hmm. I think third, flexibility and agility. People want to be able to reconfigure their offices more quickly. Right now, they're trying to figure out how to create offices with more separation, but someday maybe that won't be as necessary. And so having offices that are naturally flexible are important. And safety is super important. So we're doing work right now with a professor at MIT who's an expert in how pathogens travel through the air when you cough or you sneeze, and how furniture and screens and partitions could play a role in helping contain that. And that's important because even though someday, hopefully not too long, we'll have a vaccine, and someday beyond that, we'll get to some level of herd immunity, that doesn't mean we're out of the woods because this virus is still quite serious. And even if it's less prevalent in the population, there will be a higher awareness of infection control. And there will be people who really feel, back to empathy, really feel that I need to work in a safe environment. So we're doing a lot of things from a science-based perspective to focus on that. And then finally, work from home. So we sell a lot of furniture that people use in their homes. And we've done a ton of listening and surveys of that experience. And what we found just briefly is that it's going pretty well for people like me, people who have home offices, who have good furniture and so on. Mm-hmm. But it's more challenging for people who are mid-level managers or who are more at the beginning of their careers, where they might be in studio apartments and they never thought they would be spending all their time working there. Or they may have, in some cases, a lot of people have actually moved home with their parents and that was not their dream a couple months ago. So we know there's a lot of things people are doing to get through this crisis. But going forward, I think people will be looking for different solutions for their home as well.
Yeah. And Jim, in that answer encapsulated so much of what I understand you are as a leader. You think about both the science, the safety, and you think about comfort, feelings, emotions. And so we're going to go into that space today because this is how you approach leadership. So let's start with our first bucket of conversation, which is all around the shifting landscape of leadership skills. So what have you seen shift in the past 5 to 10 years with regards to leadership approaches, such as like a rise in these types of things or a decline in those types of skills or mindsets? How have you seen things shift?
Well, I can think about the bookending of my career here at Steelcase. As you said, I've been here more than 20 years. And at the beginning of that, Steelcase and a lot of companies were fairly hierarchical. The decisions were made at the top. The senior team would often say, hey, we're the ones running the company. And that's not the way we think of it today. Sure, there's decisions that I make. There's decisions that the senior team gets involved in. But by far, we've distributed decision-making across the company now. And that was necessary for a lot of reasons. It's necessary because companies are trying to make decisions more quickly. Like, speed really matters. And if you want one topic to talk about with a CEO, it's speed. They're all trying to figure out how to make their organizations more agile, more resilient in a time like this. How do we make decisions more quickly, more flexibly? But then also, as companies have become more global and truly global now, where it's not just they're multinational, but they actually run their companies in a more global way, they can't have all the decisions be made in one geography. So they're trying to distribute decision-making down in the organization and across the organization. And to do that, the role of senior leaders changes. So instead of just being great at making decisions, we have to now be thinking about how do we create, through culture, how do we create an organization that makes great decisions? How do we enable the organization to make better decisions? And that involves thinking about how you shape culture, how you advance culture. And it's not the way we were trained as we came up through the organization, but that seems to be what's most important now.
And we're going to talk more about this. I love this. Can you give us one example of what you mean by something you've done to in the culture to help distribute that decision. Can you just give me one story or example of what that looks like?
Oh, sure. In fact, we were dealing with COVID, and we were watching the virus spread across the world. We organized ourselves in a way that we had one central person who made decisions about principles, but then we actually appointed people all around the world who would make decisions on the ground based on the situation as it was changing right there in front of them. One night I went to bed, I got up the next morning, and I looked at my phone and I realized we had closed the plant while I was sleeping overnight. A local leader felt that they'd had the situation locally in terms of the rise of the virus. It created a situation that they weren't comfortable with, and they would rather close the plant and make sure we have everything safe before they continue to operate. And it was the right decision, and I'm glad they didn't wait for me to wake up.
Yeah, that's a great example. And we're gonna talk more about this, but so it is about enabling trust and empowerment of employees at different front lines in the organization. Is that way to understand it?
That's exactly right. And it's true in a crisis, but it's true every day. I mean, the people who know the best thing to do for your customer are the people who are standing in front of your customer right now. Like, so someplace in every company, we're a business-to-business company mostly, but there's consumer companies. Every day, there's somebody who ought to be empowered to make the right decision based on what that customer is saying to them right now. Now, to do that, you have to teach them the principles, you have to practice, you have to make sure they've got all the skills they need. But rather than forcing them to read off a script, you want them to bring their whole brain, in my opinion, and make the right decision in that moment. And I think a lot of the things we read about, customer service failures, things that make their way onto social media, wouldn't have happened if we had allowed employees on the front line to make better decisions.
Yeah. And now you gave an example related to COVID, but this has been part of the practice at Steelcase for many years now.
Yes. There's a book called Team of Teams that we started reading a number of years ago, and we've really embraced it. And the nature of that book is really this principle of, like, be super humble about what senior leaders should be there to do. Think about senior leaders as curating culture and aiding in communication and putting the right people in the right roles, letting people make decisions, reviewing the decisions and the outcomes of those decisions so everyone can keep learning, but really embrace that philosophy. And it's really the way we've tried to operate, at least for the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. And it's so impressive, too. I think these principles sound so easy in, like, a small team or a startup or where everyone kind of knows each other. But I'm so excited to have you here today because you are practicing these in a culture in a huge organization with a 100-year history. And so it's so inspiring to hear how this really works at your scale. I have one other leadership question, and then we're going to talk broadly about some myths and some more modern approaches. What qualities do you see being accelerated, amplified in leaders in 2020 in particular? Like, for example, I was talking to a leader the other week who was saying she is skeptical of anybody who feels they have the answer. There was a time in history when we looked at leaders and they should have the answers. And she's like, I'm skeptical of anyone who leads that way. What are some things that you are seeing being amplified or accelerated in the terms of the qualities or the mindsets that leaders need to possess in this context?
Well, yeah, so I'll go back to listening. I think, you know, it starts with listening, and I could just talk all about listening, and it's harder than it sounds. Senior leaders are often expected to show up in a meeting so that they can talk. In fact, you know, I'll even go beyond listening and say it's really empathy. I think you mentioned that word before. It's listening so that you can develop empathy. So if you're a good active listener, you're really trying to feel what that person's feeling. You're not trying to fix it. You're not trying to problem solve it. You're just trying to understand it. And, you know, that just goes against the grain. Like, we're supposed to be action oriented. We're supposed to be results oriented. We're supposed to be super decisive. We're supposed to be super fast. So a bad habit of leaders is we cut people off because we think we know how they're going to finish their sentence. And we're already trying to solve their problem. But maybe it's hit pause. So, you know, how do you not listen with the intention of trying to solve things? How do you learn to listen with the intention of just trying to understand and feel what that person's feeling? So again, everything is set up to not do this. You know, my schedule is fully booked. If I'm invited to go to a meeting, it's usually I'm giving talking points. You know, please come and talk about the company strategy, or talk about last quarter, or talk about, you know, whatever is going on in the business, some decision we just made, some acquisition we just made. Can you explain that to us? And those are such missed opportunities, because when I'm standing in front of them, I can do that, but I could do that in lots of other ways. I could have recorded a video, I could have sent an email. The moment when I get to actually be in front of people is a moment when I get to hear what they're thinking, or what are they working on, what are they worried about. And so you have to kind of build it into your day. You have to insist when you're invited to a meeting that you change the agenda so you have time to listen, so you can facilitate a discussion rather than answer all the questions. We made some decisions here, like my office here, which is like 5 feet over there, is on the main floor of the building. The aisle literally goes through the main floor. If you hear footsteps, it's because people are walking by on their way to the innovation center where all our product development is done. We did that on purpose because we wanted a chance to kind of accidentally run into people, even in an unscheduled way. If I get my coffee in the morning, I go to the same coffee bar as everyone else. I stand in the same line as everyone else. I park in the same parking lot. And that's intentional too. We wanted leaders to have a chance to have these kind of unplanned interactions with people they might not meet normally in a meeting. It's a chance to introduce yourself, say hello, hear how things are going. Maybe you stumble across two people who are talking to each other and you just walk up and join the conversation because you know one of them and you want to say hi. These are some things I really miss nowadays, as many people are working at home.
Yeah. What are you seeing shifting in that? So empathy is needed more now more than ever, and it's becoming harder to do as well for a lot of these reasons. What are you seeing is challenging right now, given the remote work situation?
Well, you know, on Zoom calls, and I think all of us are spending a lot of time on Zoom calls, the people who love the Zoom calls are the ones who have they put up a lot of value on efficiency. I mean, these are super efficient meetings. Every meeting starts right on time. I don't know about you, but my meetings don't always start on time when I'm in the office. They start right on time on Zoom, and they end right on time on Zoom, and everybody clicks off and clicks into the next meeting. So if you like efficiency, it's great. But I value those 5 minutes before the meeting starts. That's where I often have a chance to talk to whoever's going to be presenting, maybe give them a little encouragement or some coaching, or after the meeting, if something didn't go well, you know, to comfort someone and say, you know, it wasn't that bad and it's going to be fine. And here's what went well. And here's what you should do. Here's how you pick yourself up. And here's where you go from there. We lose those moments now as we just click on and click off. And also that conversation I mentioned earlier, where I can just walk up to people who are having an informal conversation in the hallway. If that's on Zoom, I have no idea that conversation is even happening. So as a leader now, you really have to be more intentional. You actually have to schedule things that used to be unscheduled. I look forward to the day when we're all back in the office, because it's much more natural human way of demonstrating empathy than scheduling a 5-minute meeting to say, well, I just, you know, wanted to feel what you're feeling. That might not be the time that person wanted to share it. You know, you didn't catch them in just the right moment. So I think it's tougher, but I think we can't skip it. And right now we're not doing it. So those of us who feel like we actually built our leadership reputation for acting in certain ways are finding that, you know, in this environment, we're not able to be 100% who we are.
That's such a great point, the being intentional about building it into your day, your practice. And Jim, you do practice what you preach. I am going to call you out. When we had a prep call for this webcast and you were there 5 minutes early and I dialed in 3 minutes early, and I was so delighted to have a moment where it wasn't the buttoned up conversation of our purposeful agenda. So I know you actually do this.
I do. I try to do it. I'm not perfect, but I try to do it because I find that every meeting goes well when you've got a few minutes to warm up before you say, okay, let's get going.
Yeah. But I want to move on to our next section around this idea of kind of traditional myths around leadership and more modern approaches. And I want to start with one that you've already talked about, and this myth of the CEO has all the answers, or the CEO should stand up and have a point of view and come in with smart things to say. Now, when you took office as CEO, you did not start that way. You did something completely different. Will you tell me what you did and why you did that?
Yeah, it was like, 6.5 years ago, my first day as CEO also happened to be the day of this of a leadership meeting that had been scheduled before. So we had 150 people coming in from around the world, all coming into Grand Rapids, where we have our headquarters. And the communication people were saying, okay, well, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, you got to stand up there and lay out your vision and your strategy.
Yeah.
Here's where the company's going. Everyone's going to be listening to hear what you have to say. And I'm like, yeah, right, I got to do that. But every time I thought, like, what, something doesn't feel right about that to me. I couldn't quite explain it, except it didn't feel like me to just stand up there and announce it. And yet that's what people were basically telling me I needed to do. And I knew they were right, too. So how could they be right and still I don't feel that this is quite right? So I thought about it and decided to do something different, because what I really wanted to talk about was the culture of our company and how our culture needed to advance. There's nothing wrong with it, really. It was fine. But I saw all kinds of opportunities for it to be better, stronger, for us to make faster decisions, distributed decision-making, some of the things I've already talked about. And I didn't know how to start that conversation without them feeling what I'm feeling. So instead of me giving a speech at 8 o'clock in the morning, so we broke up the 150 people into 75 teams of two. We sent each team of two out into the company where we had already organized a table of like five or six employees gathered to have a conversation for an hour with them. So 75 tables all over the company in our accounting departments, in our factories, in our distribution centers. You know, every function had some people that were gathered and the leaders went out. So I'm sitting there, like 150 people showed up. Oh, I left off a part. So when they showed up at first, we asked them to describe the company, like describe the culture of the company. So people were shouting out words and we put them up on the screen and they were wonderful. I mean, we have a great company. Wonderful words about creativity and innovation and people-oriented and human-centered and all that kind of stuff. And then off they went to these tables and they were allowed to only ask three questions. They could say, what's getting better? What's getting worse? And how does it make you feel? So that's the empathy question, right? You're not allowed to solve anything.
Not allowed to solve. I was going to say, okay.
Can't solve.
Just
in fact,
listen.
Purposefully, mm-hmm. we made sure that nobody reported up to the executives they were meeting with so that they, you weren't really allowed to solve some other function's problem. But you could. But it's tempting, right? Because you're a problem solver and you think you're there to solve problems. So the idea that you could only listen and feel. And then when they came back, we had each team of two meet with another team of two and do a quick debrief. And then they all came back together in the meeting. And the tone in the room had changed 100% from this kind of confidence and optimism and sense that our organization is flawless. People had heard things at those tables that they didn't like. You know, they heard stories about, you know, somebody who worked on second shift who needed to leave at the end of second shift to relieve her spouse, somebody on first shift who needed to leave to pick up a child from daycare who was asked to work overtime and was feeling the pressure of, will I lose my job or who's going to pick up my child? And for these leaders who thought they knew who we were, they said, I'm just shocked that we have employees who are going through these experiences. And so later in the day, when I did stand up and talk about how I felt we needed to move forward and the things we needed to do to advance our culture, I think everyone there wanted, they were actually pushing me at this point. I didn't have to convince them of what we needed to do. They were saying, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about what I just heard out there?
Right.
So empathy is super powerful, but sometimes it takes that moment to actually build it into the schedule.
Yeah.
Because I was also sitting there while they were all gone thinking, I've wasted 90 minutes of my first leadership meeting with this exercise, and what if it just completely fails? So I was glad it worked out. And, you know, somebody else, as you mentioned, I have a long history with IDEO. One of my favorite people in the whole world is David Kelly, who's one of the founders of IDEO. I have the chance to have breakfast or lunch whenever I go to an IDEO board meeting. I try to get together with David for some period of time. And he is the master of listening. And he does it because he's always asking questions. And I will go to breakfast and I'll have a list of things that I want to ask David about. And when I'm getting back in my car at the end of that breakfast, I realize I didn't get a chance to ask any of those questions because every time I asked him a question, he turned it into a question towards me and he did it again. So I'm getting smarter now, but I think the best leaders are actually people who start with humility, start by believing that they actually don't know what they need to know before they start making decisions.
Thank you for that very tangible story, of course, about David Kelly, but your practice of the three questions. You didn't just do that in that one moment. This is part of the culture and practice. So can you just say those three questions again? And
sure.
What advice do you have for people to start to use them themselves in their day-to-day interactions?
Sure. So the three questions are, what's getting better? So it helps you start the discussion with a little bit of optimism and positivity. What's getting worse? So that starts with the theory, and Jim Hackett used to say this, and I think he got it from Bo Schembechler or some football coach, that things either get better or they get worse. They don't stay the same, and I think that's really true. So what's getting better? What's getting worse? And the most important question is, how does that make you feel? And if you look for a fourth question, if you feel like you need a fourth one, it's tell me more.
It's not how do I solve it or what ideas do you have to solve it? Yeah.
Right. It's just tell me more about
tell
how you
me
feel.
More.
Just keep drilling down into the how you feel.
Okay.
So one way we've extended that practice now if you're trying to think about how to do this, if you don't have a leadership meeting. And maybe this connects back to serendipity. Now when I travel, and we do this with the whole leadership team, we schedule something called roundtables, where we will ask HR or somebody to pull together a group of 5 or 6 people that I would not normally be with. And they might be new to the organization, they may be at any point in their career, and we have lunch, or we have coffee, or we have a 1 hour session, and we go around the table. What's getting better? What's getting worse? How does it make you feel? And then in my leadership meeting with my senior staff every month, we start that meeting by having people play back what they heard in those sessions. So that feedback kind of comes up to so that everybody can kind of experience it. So it's a way of doing it kind of every day, every week, rather than waiting for an annual leadership meeting.
Hello, Co here. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Curious to know a bit more about IDOU? We're an online school where anyone can learn to solve anything creatively. If you'd like to learn more about the topics discussed today, I invite you to join our online certificate program, Foundations in Creative Leadership. Leadership today is not about knowing all the answers, but turning uncertain conditions into learning opportunities. In this program, you'll learn a unique approach to leadership that will help you tackle today's complex challenges by navigating ambiguity, collaborating across diverse perspectives, maintaining momentum with optimism, and leading with authenticity and empathy. Check it out at IDOU.com/creative-leadership-cert. Now, let's get back to the conversation. I want to go on to a second kind of myth and more modern approach. So there's this myth of you can have empathy or you can have an effective business, but it's intention to try to do both. We have people saying, you know, it's important to be both inspirational and realistic. What is the role of empathy in business?
Well, so the thing we're all really comfortable with in business is data-based decision-making, right? So this is, you learn this in business school, you learn it in business, that we have a lot of respect for data-based decisions, because it seems that the data is objective, and, you know, so you run the numbers and the numbers tell you what to do. It's really not true. As you mentioned, I was CFO. What happens is the CFO makes decisions where the numbers are pointing in two different directions. You have one analysis that tells you you should buy that piece of equipment. You have another analysis that tells you you shouldn't. You get this with acquisitions. You know, it's a great acquisition, says the strategy people, and they've got a bunch of data about that, but the price is really high, and are we ever going to get our money back? So managing tensions, that's what we do. And so the fact that there's a tension, that's where things get interesting. That's why we have people in decision-making positions. So I don't think senior leaders are really, or leaders in general, should be really focused on that. I think what they're not used to, they're used to like tie-breaking analysis A versus analysis B. What they're not used to doing is dealing with it when it comes to empathy. Sometimes a decision cuts the same way. You know, one group of people might think that's a great decision. Another group of people are really going to be disappointed and hurt by that decision. And when you practice empathy, you start to feel all those feelings. And you can have a tendency to want to solve all the world's problems and be able to make a decision that pleases everyone. And that's not the point. Once you practice empathy, it's not about trying to please everyone. It's about being fully informed. So you're not surprised at how different people might react to your decision or the impact your decision might have on them, because you've actually spent time listening and feeling and engaging. And often you do find, like in design thinking, that when you have two things that seem like they're irreconcilable, that with design thinking, you actually can find an answer that rounds the edges a little bit. So it actually does consider the needs of these people better than if you had never considered it. And by the way, empathy, in any great company, they may not call it empathy, but they've been doing empathy. So understanding emerging customer needs, it's usually not about the things people say they need. It's the things they need, and they can't say it. They can't articulate it. It's a latent need. You learn about latent needs by practicing empathy, by actually watching how they're using existing products, seeing how they're hacking those products, seeing what they've, you know, developed themselves to kind of fill a gap. Even if they don't tell you why, you kind of go, why are you doing that? You know, why are you carrying that this way instead of that way? Why aren't you using the handle that was provided with the product? You start to understand that. You also understand, practicing empathy, how sometimes internal policies we have in companies can have unanticipated consequences.
Yep.
That you could maybe be more thoughtful about.
Yeah. I do want to hear one last kind of myth that is often talked about, is that decisions, especially in large companies, should happen top down. And you've already talked about you were building a culture of distributed leadership. But here's the thing I want to know. So as you are on a journey as a culture becoming more about distributed leadership and enabling that, did it all flow smoothly? Did it just work because because there was a decision that this is how we want to operate? What were there surprises or what didn't work, and how did you move forward?
That's a great question. And yeah, the myth there is that if you distribute decision-making, everybody's going to be happy about that.
Yeah. And great decisions will happen everywhere easily?
Yes. And no, it won't. So, yeah, we definitely, it did not go well at first. In fact, I thought, maybe this was a big mistake and I'm going to really distract the whole company and maybe we should put it back the way it was. So we stayed with it and I'm glad we did because we broke through. But I learned a lot. So for example, like in some cultures, the idea that people would like more decision-making like throughout the organization seems to make a lot of sense. I mean, that's kind of how I think, being who I am and the culture I come from. That's how I think that, people in their first job, a year or two into their job would like more authority to make decisions. But in other cultures, they don't really think that way. So there's cultures where they say, no, you have the job, you are in this job, you are to make those decisions. I will implement your decisions, but I don't want to be handed that decision because that's your job, and I don't want to be held accountable for it if something goes wrong. And man, I just didn't understand that. So we had to kind of slow down and take some more time to build empathy and understand these cultural differences in terms of how people see decision-making responsibilities and so on. So we did, and that helped. We still got to the same place. We just realized we had to get there at a different speed and with more preparation in some places. A second thing we learned is even in cultures like my primary culture here, let's say the U.S. culture, decisions were still buoyant. We would push decisions down in the organization and they would just rise back up. And at first it seemed like the senior leaders must be, overruling people and so on. But when we actually dug into it, realized no, the people who owned the decision weren't comfortable making the decision. So they would ask for coaching. But what they were really asking for is, can somebody please make this decision for me so that, because I don't know what to do, or I can't get consensus. That's something you see sometimes. People believe that we're going to get 100%. We had this morning. It was an important topic our leadership team is meeting on. I couldn't be part of that meeting this morning, so I had somebody else lead that meeting. And I asked how it went, and they said, well, everyone had a different opinion, which of course, that's the way it is. So that's why we have, in the end, somebody has to make the decision, but you never get the comfort of it being completely consensus-based. So as we distributed decision-making, we realized people weren't comfortable if there were people disagreeing. They would tend to kind of push it up the chain, or they had an uncomfortable relationship with accountability. So it is true that if you make a decision, you're accountable for the outcome. It doesn't mean you have to be perfect. Like, I've made more mistakes probably than anybody else around here, and I got to be CEO. You just have to have a good batting average. You have to have a good average success rate. And secondly, even if you own a decision, some people saw that they're at the other end of the spectrum. So you gave me this decision, so let me make the decision, and I shouldn't have to answer for it, and I shouldn't have to explain it to you because you told me to make the decision. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work that way for me. I have a board of directors and they have shareholders to worry about. And no matter who you are in the company, you're accountable to somebody. I get to make the decisions, but the board's going to ask me 20 questions about every major decision. Why I made it that way? What did I look at? Did I consider this? That's their right. And that's really how the world works. The myth, I guess, is that if you just delegate decision-making, that everything's going to go great. The learning is that you have to recognize people are different and you have to be careful and take care and take time as you make that choice.
Well, and just even embedded in that example, there were some of the what we often refer to as the soft skills that are actually the hard skills in leadership. And so you talked about it became important for people to become comfortable with discomfort or disagreement, to learn how to build the consensus making skills. Like, what does it mean? And then also back to listening. And so all of those are embedded in that process of learning how to make better decisions and being held accountable for them. And those are the pieces that not a lot of people openly acknowledge is what are the leadership skills.
And you have to, I think, as a leader, stop making decisions. So that sounds like such an obvious thing, but when people would come to me or any of us with one of those buoyant decisions, it's so tempting to just go, pick option A. And yet you can't. You know, you have to actually stop yourself and say, well, let me ask you three questions about it. You know, the work you did and what do you think and what could possibly go wrong if you picked A versus B. You help that, you put the decision back in their hands and you give them, and that's how you help them build confidence about their decisions.
I see. So I am going to move this to some Q&A on this topic. I'm going to continue on this thread. So we have one person talking about, this idea of empowering. Empowerment sounds great, but sometimes there are bad decisions that come out of it. How do you process that, or how do you guide those moments?
Yeah, and I've made bad decisions. So, and I got to be CEO, as I said. So, you know, bad decisions happen, and the only thing that's wrong with a bad decision is how long it takes you to figure out it was a bad decision so you can change course. So, you know, that's one of the things I think when people make a decision, they can sometimes become wedded to their own decision. So that's something you teach too. Like, how do we actually get comfortable with making a decision, seeing how it's going, making adaptations, like little tweaks to it, or sometimes stop and go back and regroup. That's okay. You know, that's really the way most things happen. Like, you know, there's a story that people usually tell when they're standing on a stage about, you know, some business decision they made. Real life is usually not quite so linear. It's you know, a lot of inventions where the thing you weren't actually trying to invent, you just kind of stumbled across it as you were making some other mistake. So I think that's true, that bad decisions can happen. The second thing is learning happens through mistakes. So if you, the bad decision you can make is you might be so upset about the mistake you made or somebody else made that you just decide to move on instead of actually having that uncomfortable conversation about, okay, what did we learn from that?
Of course.
So we had a decision to launch a new product. It was supposed to take 6 months and cost, you know, some amount of, let's say it was supposed to cost $1 million. It was 18 months. It still hadn't been launched. It was 24 months. At that point, the amount that we had spent on it was two or three times what we originally thought we'd spend on it. And then we launched it and we sold half as much as we thought we would sell. So there's like nothing good about that story.
No.
And yet when I was with the team, you know, reflecting on it, and I asked that question, well, what would we have done differently? They said, well, I don't know if we would have done anything differently. And that's the wrong answer. I mean, that's worse than the mistake. Mm. So you go, okay, let's time out.
Yeah.
You know, I know what I would have done differently. If I had known everything I know now, we would never have done the project. And like everyone kind of sat back in their chairs, but like, I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just trying to point out that we have to acknowledge that that was a failure. And now we have to go back and go, okay, what were the things we could have done differently? Because if you don't answer that question, it's not just what did we learn? It's what would you do differently now that you know everything you know? I think we still would have launched the product. We would have developed it differently. We would have gotten the right team in place at the beginning. We would have forced ourselves to make some decisions earlier because we kind of let them drag on. There was plenty of things we could have done differently. So I think that's how you make mistakes, but you make fewer mistakes if you build this kind of learning culture that goes along with decisions.
And again, embedded in that story, I appreciate you sharing a simple question you use there. You're like, what did we learn? What could we have done better? And and just modeling that in each of your conversations is part of how you build that learning culture.
Right. And celebrating that. So it's not about, it's not a whodunit.
Yeah.
We're not trying to hold people accountable. It sounds like we're going to fire somebody. This is about, let's hold ourselves accountable for learning.
To learn better. We have a few questions around the theme of moving from empathy to action or commitment. So one person asks, how do you go beyond empathy to transform it into collective decision-making? People might find it hard to feel the commitment. Do you have an example or guidance of moving from empathy into actually making some decisions collaboratively?
In ideal words, we would describe this as divergent and convergent processes. So in the divergent phase of problem solving, what we call the think phase, we encourage people to go broad. So in the think phase, you're trying to understand the problem completely. You're trying to reach out and engage as many people as you can in terms of analytics, in terms of experience, but also in terms of feeling. What do people feel about the problem? What does their instinct tell them? What experienced people, what are they saying? Less experienced people who are maybe more connected with the most recent societal trends, what are they feeling? So the test we use for the think phase is how broad have you gone? How many people have you included in this decision-making? When it comes to the decision itself, though, we go the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So
we
it's still case at least, we don't believe in team problem solving. We don't believe in, you know, the whole team decided something. We believe you actually have to have a point of view owner. One person has to feel the authority to make that decision to get away from this idea of consensus. Sometimes the best decision might not be the majority opinion. And anyway, if you make a decision, whether it's the majority opinion or the minority opinion, if you make that decision and then it works great, or let's say it doesn't work, it's hard to pin down like who actually made the decision. So people go, well, you know, it's really the team, and we have the whole team and everything. Everything goes from active voice to passive voice in those meetings. That's a bad sign. You know, decisions were made, you know, mistakes happened. That defers learning. So we really think you have to get divergent in the think phase. That's how you get that inclusion. That's how you get that super participative. Everybody's involved. That's the collectivism part. And then somebody's got to actually make the decision. That person who makes the decision has to demonstrate in the discussion explaining their decision how they incorporated all the things they heard. But it doesn't mean they had to please everyone.
I see. That's an important nuance. Thank you, Jim. That's great insight. So the last one, what can leaders do to discourage burnout? And it goes back to the beginning of our conversation where at this time, it is a human crisis. We hear themes of human capital and how do you keep relationships fueled? So what are your thoughts on how leaders can discourage burnout or be mindful of it at this time?
Yeah, so a lot is being understood about this. And you know, this is a great human experiment of sending everybody home, and we're all learning what happens when you break out of the patterns that have served you well and you find yourself, you know, working in your kitchen. We lose boundary, first of all. So boundaries are actually kind of important. As much as people talk about integrating work and life, when you have complete kind of blurring of the boundary between work and life, then work and life are all blended together. And so there's a lot of research out there that say, at least for some people, I'll say most people, being able to compartmentalize one and the versus the other is super important. So, you know, being able to get up from where, like work where you work and then leave that place and then go do life where you do life, but try not to blend those spaces too much. For burnout at every level, and we've studied executives, we've studied doctors and teachers, and for all of you, for all of us, I think I have a little formula that I use that I think it's super helpful, and we've come up with it from a bunch of research, other people's research mostly. Like if you study athletes and you go, well, how do athletes sustain performance and they don't burn out physically or mentally? How do the best doctors, the best teachers do this? There's a three-step process you see again and again. They prepare, they perform, and they recover. So the athlete's got, you know, on the bus on the way to the game, they've got the headphones on. The pitcher who's going to play baseball today isn't going to, don't talk to me. You know, they've all got their little rituals about what I do as I'm preparing to perform. And then they perform. And then after they perform, there's a recovery. So they might go to the whirlpool. They might ice down. They might stretch. They might do whatever they're going to do. That's the physical side. Mentally, we're the same way. So being able to have a ritual you go through, like before I got on the call here with you, we were talking about this. So we did a little text setup before this call started to make sure the microphones were working and everything. And then if you notice, I left for 15 minutes because I wanted to go clear my mind. This is kind of a meditation practice a bit for me. And I go and I clear my mind and I just breathe. I think again about, you know, what this conversation might be about. I try to picture myself in the conversation. And then I come out and I perform, so I'm on the call. And then when I'm done, I've got another meeting I've got to run to, but secretly I've actually got a little 5 minutes thing I'm going to do to clear my mind again, to recover, and then to think about what that next meeting's about. When we're overscheduled, when we feel like we're fractured, we're trying to do two things at once a lot. We're multitasking. We're in one meeting while we're sending emails about the last meeting. We're still angry about something that happened at 10 a.m. this morning, and now we're supposed to make some decision at 2 o'clock, and we're kind of messed up. We're kind of almost impaired from a decision-making perspective. We're maybe not showing empathy towards ourselves, saying, you know, we're human, and you should expect that after every performance experience, you're going to need some time to recover and be kind to yourself and then allow yourself a little time to get ready for what's next. So if you can remember that process and try to practice it, prepare, perform, recover, you get to be totally in the moment, doing whatever you're doing, and that's all you're doing. And then at the end of the day, at least for me, I go home some days feeling more energized than when I arrived at work in the morning if I follow that practice.
That is such wonderful advice. Jim, this whole conversation has been filled with advice, experiences, tips that we can all start to bring into our personal experience as well as our leadership practice. Thank you so much. Last question, any piece of inspiration, something that's inspiring you these days, or words of wisdom that you want to leave us with?
I'll say, you know, a couple things. One is to look for resilience. Resilience is actually happening everywhere. We're going through something none of us could have imagined. It's a science fiction movie. We're all living in it. And yet, There's signs of tragedy and there's signs of sadness, and we can focus on those. But there's also amazing signs of resilience, where we're figuring it out, and we're going to figure it out, and the scientists are going to figure it out, and so that gives me great hope. And the second thing is, I mentioned learning a couple times. Learning is a lifelong thing. One of the things I challenge myself with, I talk to friends and family about it, is how do we use these times when we find ourselves not doing all the stuff we normally do? How can we use all that found time to invest in ourselves and to learn about something we never learned about before? So I'm trying to get better at guitar, but this year I'm learning how to play a game called Go, which is this game that AlphaGo, the computer, the AI computer, finally beat the number one player in Go. Go is an ancient game from China, Korea, Japan is where it's most popular today. And I have no good reason. Honestly, I don't know anybody who plays Go. I play against the computer. But I just decided I was going to figure out how to do that. And why not? You know, like, I got nothing else going on.
That's a perfect, nothing. Slight bit of sarcasm there at the end.
I mean, at home, like if I don't replace what I used to do with something else, and I'm just going to work all the time, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun. So, just try to find that thing that's inspiring me. I am really hopeless at it still. I'm a very a beginner player, but I'm getting a little bit better every time I play.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of, it's just fun to have something in your life where you're not trying to be an expert. You're just trying to get to mediocre.
Yeah.
And you discover that, you know, you can still learn stuff. You can learn stuff about things that you just did because it was interesting and fun.
What a perfect note. Thank you, Jim. So we'll end on resilience and learning. I hope all of you go off to feel inspired and try to learn something new. Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Confidence from IDEO-U. Stay up to date on our Creative Confidence conversations and send your questions for our upcoming guests. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and sign up for our IDEO-U newsletter at IDEOU.com/CC. Thanks for joining us.